Presentation by our session facilitator, Michelle Mahoney, and let her get started. Michelle?
Okay, great. Thanks, Jean, and thanks everybody for joining us today. I think we have a very good webinar here for you today. This is part of a series of webinars that we do on mining-related topics. This is the first one in 2020, and like I said, we're very excited. I wanted to direct everyone to this website on Cluin. It's our mining focus area, where you can learn about other training events such as this one, and also in-person meetings. There are new publications and other materials, case studies, news stories, and things related to cleaning up mining sites. So I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of this and that you check out some of the resources that are available on this page as well. And as I mentioned, today's webinar is part of our mining webinar series that we've been doing for quite a few years now. If you would like to check out any of the previous mining webinars that we've done, they are all archived on Cluin at this webpage that you see on this slide here. So please check that out, and you can watch and listen to any of these webinars on your own time. You can download them and just check out some of the things that we've done in the past. And if you have any ideas for future webinars, you can always send me an email or Jean an email. And letting us know what other topics you'd like to see. So for today's webinar, as Jean mentioned, we're going to be talking about the Eagle Mine Superfund site case study. This is a site in Colorado that's an example of successful EPA and state collaboration overseeing a potentially responsible party conducting cleanup of an abandoned mining and milling complex. We're very excited to have two great presenters on this topic, and I'm going to introduce them to you now. We have Jamie Miller, who is a remedial project manager in the Superfund Division in our EPA Region 8 office, which is located in Denver, Colorado. Jamie manages the Eagle Mine Superfund site, and she's also part of a team for the Colorado Smelter Superfund site, so we'll have her talking about the details for Eagle. And then we also have Kayleen Castelli, who's also with EPA Region 8, and she's with their regional council in the Superfund group. And she focuses on complex corporate succession, bankruptcy, reuse, and redevelopment, all related to CERCLA. So we have these two very excellent presenters, and without any further ado, I'd like to turn the presentation over to them.
Thanks, Michelle. This is Jamie Miller. I'm the RPM for the Eagle Mine Superfund site, and so co-presenting with me, like Michelle said, is Kayleen Castelli. And we thought this case study would be a good topic for the mining webinar series because the Eagle Mine site is an example of where EPA and the state have successfully collaborated overseeing a PRP, cleaning up an abandoned mining and milling complex, which we all know can be a very complicated endeavor. My state of Colorado counterpart, Dustin McNeil, could not be here today, but he did provide input into this presentation. The case study will present on our site's background just to get you acquainted with the site. We're going to talk about the complex regulatory framework at the site, our complicated enforcement history with the PRP and the state, and the robust remedy that we have implemented at the site. So it's also, Eagle Mine is a good example of a site nearing completion in the Superfund process, and so we're going to talk a little bit about the what you should consider when you're working on a Superfund site approaching the finish line. The photos on the screen that you see right now are taken in Belden, the historic mining area on the site. So to kick things off, our site's claim to fame is that a Steven Seagal movie was filmed at Eagle, Under Siege 2, Dark Territory. I believe it's on Amazon Prime if you want to watch it. This is just our agenda for the webinar. I'll just give some site background to get you acquainted with the site, both geographically and historically. Then Kayleen will go into our complicated enforcement history and the regulatory framework under which we operate. I'll then talk a little bit about the technical details of the remedy at the site through the lens of our multiple enforcement agreements. And then we will cover what we have left to do at Eagle to get to the finish line. This photo on the screen is taken at the foot of the wooden trestle on site that houses the pipeline once used to carry tailings down from the mine to the tailings impoundment area at the site. Okay, for a little bit of background, the Eagle Mine site is a large abandoned mining and milling facility located along the banks of the Eagle River near Minturn, Colorado, at an elevation of around 8,400 feet. It's around 2 hours west of Denver on I-70, depending on ski traffic. The 235-acre site includes the Eagle Mine workings in the area we call Belden, the abandoned town of Gilman, the mill tailings ponds areas, of which there are two, the old tailings pile and what we call the consolidated tailings pile, Rex Flats, the Molloy Park wetlands, and Rock Creek Canyon. The site is bordered on the south and west by the White River National Forest, which includes the Holy Cross Wilderness Area. The Eagle River is the major surface water resource affected by the contamination on site. The headwaters of the river originate 15 miles above Red Cliff, and the river flows north-northwest through the site and eventually joins the Colorado River. The Eagle River is used as water supply and recreation, both fishing and water sports. Downstream of the site, there is a water intake for the Eagle River Water and Sanitation District, which is the water supplier for the Vail Valley. The top photo that you see here is an overview looking northwest from Highway 24, which follows along the site boundary. In view are Rex Flats and the trestle. So in the forefront of the top photo, you see the trestle carrying the pipeline in the Rex Flats area. And across the road from Rex Flats, you see that flat area, that's the old tailings pile. The bottom photo is an overview of the water treatment plant on site, the surge ponds, and our sludge cell at the site, all of which are housed on the top of the consolidated tailings pile. To give you an idea of the site characteristics, this photo that you see is from winter 2019 when an avalanche came through the site. The shed on the left of the picture houses infrastructure for our seepage collection system coming down the canyon, so that illustrates how the site climate can impact the remedy both in functionality and accessibility. This graph shows snowpack over the last few years. The dark blue line on the graph shows us that 2019 was a heavy snow year for us at the site, and the PRP worked hard to handle all the water treatment required for that amount of snow. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the mining history at the site. Mining began in the area in around 1879. Originally, gold and silver were the focus of the mining activity, but around 1905, lead and zinc became the primary metals mined. Pittsburgh Gold and Zinc built a mill in Gilman in 1905 to roast and separate ore. The principal mines were consolidated into what is now known as the Eagle Mine in 1916. An underground mill was constructed in 1929, and that is when tailings began being slurried down canyon via a pipeline for deposition in the old tailings pile. The mill was closed, and most mining activities ceased in 1977. Then the mine was sold to Glenn Miller in 1983. This is important to remember, as we now have a PRP operating a remedy at the site where they own no property. Miller conducted a very limited mining operation until 1984, when the electrical power was shut off due to unpaid bills and the workings flooded. At the height of production, the Eagle Mine was the largest zinc producer in Colorado. The PRP at the site today is ViacomCBS, which I will just refer to as the PRP throughout the presentation. The photos you see on the screen right now show the New Jersey Zinc Company logo. This was a predecessor in the corporate chain to our current PRP. The photo on the left of the screen shows some of the historic mining structures in the Belden area that still exist today. Gilman was the company town for the mine. At its height, it reportedly had a population of around 1,000 people. The town was abandoned in 1979, but it is still standing today. In the forefront of the middle photo, you see the miner residences. There is another section of town on the other side of the shaft house where the mining managers live. So that area has some larger structures, larger houses. The shaft house that you see in the middle of the middle photo houses the entrance to the Wilkes Bar shaft, which is a 900-foot shaft that was the main entrance for the miners into the mine. The elevators used to transport the miners down the shaft are still present in the shaft house, and you can see those in the photo on the left. There is an urban legend that the town was abandoned because of the mine closing, But the reality is that the county issued the town a violation because the septic systems were corrupted and leaking, and that is the true reason that the town was abandoned. As with any ghost town, trespassing is a huge issue for us at the site. We coordinate with the Eagle County Sheriff to discourage trespassing. It's gotten so bad that now the sheriff tickets people for trespassing on their first offense. And on the photo on the right that you see, I took that photo last summer when we were exploring Gilman, and that is just an outbuilding that was full of abandoned drill cores, and this one building had three or four rooms full of cores like this, so that was pretty an interesting discovery we made last year. We deal with four types of mine waste at Eagle: numerous waste rock piles, enormous amounts of tailings that were slurried down canyon to the tailings pile, highly contaminated roaster waste, and the never-ending problem of acid mine drainage. A big focus of the early remedy at the site dealt with the roaster waste. Due to the inefficiency of the roasting and magnetic separation process, waste produced by the roasting process contains high concentrations of metal. I assume this audience knows, but in snapshot, mine waste contain metals. While metals can be harmful to human health, the primary concern at the Eagle Mine has been ecological risk. Metals bind to the gills of fish and can also affect their food supply. This is an aerial photo from 1985, pre-remediation. Tailings were slurried from the underground mill in Belden down canyon and dumped into the OTP. Tailings were also placed along the pipeline corridor in wrecked flats to prevent the wooden trestle from burning, and so this area also required remediation. You can see the river running orange through the middle of this photo on the site. Once the OTP, or old tailings pile, was full, the pipeline was extended and tailings were put into the new tailings pile, which we now refer to as the consolidated tailings pile. So if you hear us talking about the CTP, this is the area that we're referring to. And on the slide, you can see, I just wanted to point out the area where our current water treatment plant resides. So just in your mind, when you're seeing pictures later on, this was pre-remediation of the area of the water treatment plant. For purposes of this presentation, we're going to focus on operable unit 1 at the site, but the site has been broken down into three separate operable units. OU1 is focused on site-wide surface water quality. It's an ecological risk OU, and it is all the remedial components are targeted at achieving surface water ARRs. OU2 is the ghost town that I showed on an earlier slide of Gilman. This is a human health risk-based OU. We know that if the town of Gilman wanted to be redeveloped by anyone, that there would have to be some additional remediation taking place there. And OU3, this is the redevelopment OU at the site, and it is focused on soils in Rex Flat, the Malloy Park area, and the old tailings pile. This OU is targeted at additional remediation to achieve residential use standards for redevelopment at the site.
Okay, so this is Kaylee Castelli. I'm the site enforcement attorney at Eagle, and I am going to try to whiz through almost 4 years of enforcement history at the site, focusing only on operable unit 1. So first we'll do a speedy overview of the enforcement history, and then we'll dive briefly in on the impacts of certain parts of the enforcement history on the site. And we're using enforcement history as a lens here because at sites with potentially responsible parties, or PRPs, the enforcement documents kind of guide our approach and our working relationships at the site. So in 1983, the state of Colorado filed a complaint against the PRPs for natural resource damages under CERCLA. And then later in 1985, the state amended their complaint to add claims for response costs under CERCLA, as well as other pendant claims under state law, like nuisance or tort and negligence. And it's worth noting here that in addition to the cleanup requirements of CERCLA that we typically think of, Superfund does require that natural resources be restored to a state to the way they were before injury from environmental contaminants. And for context here, Superfund was very new at the time, and this was, you know, the first wave of Superfund sites to be started since the law was passed. Then in 1986, EPA listed the site on the National Priorities List for the NPL. Also in 1986, EPA and the state entered into a memorandum of agreement, and I'll call this an internal relationship defining document, which we'll talk more about later. Then in 1988, the state resolved its lawsuit with a successor to the PRP, and for simplicity's sake, I'll just call everybody the PRP. So they entered into a consent decree and remedial action plan, which is what we now think of as a statement of work, to implement cleanup from the state's lawsuit. And then later, that consent decree was amended several times to amend the remedy. Then in 1993, after some problems at the site with the selected remedy, EPA kind of jumped in and issued the Operable Unit 1 Record of Decision, or OU1 ROD. And this required additional remedial actions that were in addition to, but without directly addressing the state's cleanup. And this is where, and we'll talk about this more in the following slides, but we start to create a piecemeal approach for both the remedy and enforcement at the site. So we quickly issued a unilateral administrative order to the PRP in 1994 to kick off cleanup under the ROD. Then in 1995, we see our second internal relationship defining document, and the state and EPA entered into another site-specific document, which we have called the Site-Specific Enforcement Agreement, or SSEA. This related to the 1996 EPA state and PRP consent decree. I'll call it the EPA consent decree to kind of distinguish it from the state's initial consent decree in 1988. And this superseded the unilateral administrative order from 1994, but didn't supersede the 1988 CD. And we issued this to begin or continue implementing remedial actions from the OU1 ROD. Then in 1999, EPA issued an explanation of significant differences at the site to add the Liberty Well, which Jamie will talk about later. The site got construction completion in 2001, so there wasn't a lot happening from an agency decision perspective or from an enforcement document perspective. Then in 2004, EPA and the state signed a statewide state memorandum of agreement. So this one wasn't specific to the site, but did impact the site. That was our third internal relationship defining document. Then in 2009, the Colorado Water Quality Control Commission modified standards for the amount of zinc, cadmium, and copper allowed in the Eagle River. EPA became aware of this in a five-year review. And as a result of previous cleanup efforts at the site, we saw that the Eagle River was typically meeting the new water quality standards, except in March and April when metals concentrations can be elevated. So the exceedance necessitated amending the OU1 ROD so that the remedy was still protective of human health and the environment. And due to new technology, we also for the first time realized that arsenic was a contaminant of concern. So this culminated in 2017 to the OU1 ROD amendment. Along with this, we have another and our fourth internal relationship defining document, which is a site-specific memorandum of understanding. And in 2018, EPA issued a friendly unilateral administrative order to the PRP so that we could expeditiously begin implementing work from the OU1 ROD amendment. So that's 37 years of history for you. Where are we now, though? We still have some obstacles left at the site, in part because, you know, this was one of the initial sites after Superfund passed and its long history. So So one of the issues that we're dealing with right now is that we have a patchwork enforcement strategy for OU1. On the last slide, you saw that there were 4 internal relationship defining documents and then 3 external, and by that I mean documents between the agencies and the PRP. And from these arrows on the slide, you can see that the 1986 site memorandum of agreement applies to the state's consent decree. The 1995 site-specific enforcement agreement applies to EPA's consent decree. Then the 2018 site MOU applies to our friendly UAO in 2018. And then on top of all of this, we have the kind of umbrella state memorandum of agreement. And so, as you can probably imagine, this is a little confusing to both the internal site team, which is EPA and the state, and then also to kind of our larger site team, which includes the PRPs. We don't typically work on work, you know, specific to an enforcement document. We work on work holistically at the site. So things don't divvy up nicely into which internal document or external document we're talking about. So it's a bit tough to ensure that we're following the exact appropriate course of action. You know, one document might call for 30 days turnaround, or one document might call for 40. I think we have a really successful team dynamic on the ground, but you can see that we have a lot of competing enforcement documents here. Another issue that we're dealing with is that a past consent decree has several provisions that create ambiguity around critical required work at the site, like the water treatment plant. And additionally, some provisions, you know, like modification provisions or additional work, were written very narrowly so that when applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs, when we determined that they weren't protective of human health and the environment, it was ambiguous whether we could update the consent decree to require the additional work. And I think at the time there was generally a trend to negotiate these enforcement documents quite narrowly with the idea to limit the agency's ability to be flexible. But we're realizing now, as time's gone on, that that strategy backfired at the site because our documents are inflexible and they're hard to work with. Then we have a couple of regulatory issues. We have 2 state-issued discharge permits at the site, one for the water treatment plant and one for the Liberty Well. And sometimes CERCLA and the Clean Water Act don't approach the same situations identically, and this can create problems or confusion. Colorado recently set the limit for arsenic in our segment of the Eagle River at 0.02 micrograms per liter in the surface water. And EPA ultimately determined that a technical and practicability waiver, or you might hear them called TI waivers more commonly, was necessary because it was technically impractical to meet the 0.02 micrograms per liter at the site due to a variety of reasons, including background concentrations in the Eagle River exceeded the standard, analytical methods couldn't measure that low, and treatment technologies hadn't been developed to effectively remove arsenic consistently to meet those levels. And I think that this is a statewide issue for all dischargers, even public water suppliers right now, but it's certainly an issue at our site. So the agency selected an alternate remedial goal of 3 micrograms per liter for the site to use in lieu of the state standard. But it created a problem because in an updated discharge permit from Colorado Water Quality, the water treatment plant had a report-only requirement, then 6 micrograms per liter, and then 0.02, and these didn't match up with our 3 micrograms per liter that we had selected in the remedy. So we have a mismatch. Then the other enforcement regulatory issue is a 303D listing issue. In 2019, the Colorado Water Quality Control Commission proposed resegmenting part of the Eagle River that runs through our site, as well as delisting some of the contaminants from our segments of the Eagle River from the impaired waters list. And it's worth noting here that there's a difference in how we look at data under CERCLA versus how the state might look at data for a 303D listing. CERCLA looks at a data set that's a snapshot in time. By just, I think, by virtue of the process, we analyze data in a feasibility study and then select a final remedy, whereas 303D looks at data in a more continuous process. Also under the Clean Water Act, you know, the water is clean and then can be delisted from the impaired segment if it's clean 85% of the time. And our approach is different under CERCLA and leads us to a different conclusion. You know, we have impairment under CERCLA because the water at the time of the feasibility study exceeded standards. And then again, we discovered that during five-year reviews, we were still exceeding standards, and any exceedance counts and points us towards the need for additional remediation. So it's just, you know, again, important to be cognizant that different statutes look at data differently, and it leads you to different conclusions. So even if the Eagle River is segmented differently or analyzed or delisted, it doesn't impact us in this case from a CERCLA perspective. But it's not ideal from a messaging and optics perspective. You know, at the same time that under the Clean Water Act, we're saying the stream is clean enough, under CERCLA, we're saying we need more remedial work to get the water cleaner. There's a mismatch there. And, you know, we wanted to flag this too because at least in our region, the Clean Water Office and the CERCLA office don't typically work as closely together, but it's worth noting that CERCLA and the Clean Water Act do have some overlap. So I raised some obstacles, and I just wanted to quickly discuss a solution. So our solution is to negotiate a new consent decree for OU1. First, we plan to consolidate and close out those old enforcement documents so that we're operating under just, you know, one enforcement document and fewer internal relationship defining documents. Then we plan to adopt a permit equivalent document for our discharge points so that we're consistent with the remedy that we've selected in our decision documents. Then we plan to consolidate all outstanding remedial work into a remedial action statement of work and then an operations and maintenance statement of work. And these have all been thoroughly vetted with our past decision documents so that they're supported and we've included the things that we need to include. Last, we plan to adopt broader and more flexible modification and additional work provisions so that we can accomplish what we need to now and also accommodate changes in the future without having to renegotiate a new enforcement document for every new decision that we need to make, which we are quickly learning is quite expensive and time-consuming. So that's a quick overview of the enforcement history, and I'm going to turn it back over to Jamie.
All right. Thanks, Kayleen. Now that Kayleen has covered the enforcement history at the site, I'm going to get into the technical aspects of the remedy. Let me make sure I'm able to click through. Okay, perfect. Work at the site has been conducted in multiple phases through multiple agreements with the PRP, as Kayleen talked about. I will walk through each agreement and talk about the work covered in each phase. I think that's a good way to kind of structure the phasing of the remedial work at the site. As Kayleen said, the site started as an NRD claim, which resulted in the 1988 agreement between the state of Colorado and the PRP. At this point in the game, EPA was involved in a review role, but not as a party to the agreement, so keep that in mind. EPA reviewed the remedy proposed in the agreement and found it environmentally acceptable, but expressed reservations about its success. And I'll just note that environmentally acceptable is not a term that I have ever come across in my recent years of work at EPA. I think that was an 80s term, but that's what it says in the document. So this original cleanup focused on flooding the workings through bulkheading and collecting roaster waste and tailings from throughout the site and consolidating that material into the consolidated tailings pile. As with any mining site, our mantra is to keep clean water clean and capture dirty water for treatment. So the original remedy also incorporated capping of the CTP to limit infiltration and included construction of a number of run-on and runoff controls that I'll talk about on the next slide. I just wanted to include this table on this slide. This is from the CDRAP, and it is just the bulkhead construction information. We have 8 bulkheads at the site, and so that was, you know, the biggest part of the original remedy at the site. The CDRAP also included diversion structures at the site, so ditches, trenches, and culverts around contaminated areas to keep clean water clean at both the consolidated tailings pile and Rock Creek. It included the installation of groundwater extraction trenches at the consolidated tailings pile to capture that contaminated groundwater that we know we have there. A big point to include here is that the original remedy did not include water treatment. It included a system to pump collected water back into the mine workings up to an elevation of 8,610 feet. We now know that level is well above the level where we see seepage of acid mine drainage at the surface from the mine pull through fractures. So just keep in mind that as we move through the different phases of work, that the original remedy did not include treatment as part of the remedy. And I included a couple of other items on each of these slides of additional things included in the remedy in each of these agreements, but it's just too much to try to cover all at once, so you can read the slide as we're going along. In late 1989, early 1990, we were seeing extremely high levels of metals in the Eagle River due to the seepage occurring from the mine pool because of that pumping of the water back into the mine. This failure of the remedy necessitated an amendment to the state and PRP agreement. This amendment covered the construction of the water treatment plant and implemented water treatment as a part of the remedy. So this was a big milestone for the site. It also included a number of other components to facilitate water treatment, like a seepage collection system and creation of a temporary sludge disposal cell. And as you'll see, if you look at the photos on the slide, these are from 1991 when the Eagle River turned a particularly nasty shade of orange. And the photo on the left just showcases what we're talking about when we talk about the seepage from the mine working. This slide is just to give you an idea of the influent and effluent concentrations at the site that we're working with. These are our contaminants of concern, arsenic, cadmium, copper, and zinc. We employ the tried and true lime and acid treatment technique at the water treatment plant. We just have a very standard treatment plant that works very effectively and very consistently. Our PRP has contractors at the site who are very well-versed and have been on the site for a long time, and so we have a lot of confidence in the treatment plant as part of the remedy. In the early 90s, EPA felt there was additional remediation needed, so we decided to issue a record of decision like Kayleen alluded to earlier. The 93 record of decision issued by EPA was viewed as an addendum to the work undertaken by the state and was consistent with the state remedy. So the ROD work was implemented via a consent decree between EPA and the PRP with state involvement. The biggest component added to the remedy in the 93 ROD was the maintenance of the mine pool at a level where we don't see seepage via the construction of a mine drawdown system that gets piped to the treatment plant for treatment. Although capping the consolidated tailings pile was included in the earlier state and PRP agreement, EPA included a schedule for capping the CTP within 2 construction seasons because I think everyone agreed in the importance of getting the CTP capped to limit infiltration into those tailings that had been consolidated. The photo you're looking at here is just the mine drawdown system at Adit 5 at the site. Maintaining the mine pool elevation is a critical component of the remedy at the site. Historically, like I said, we didn't realize that this was going to be such a critical component, but now this is something we really focus on. We know that around 84-80 we start to see seepage, so we work to keep it under that elevation. The mindful control level that you see on this graph, so you see at the top of the graph at 8500, that is just a surrogate for us to compare to on this graph. We've been negotiating what the number needed to be in the CD for the mindful control level. So EPA, the state, and the PRP have been having numerous discussions about what that level needs to be. And so we haven't definitively decided on anything, but we know that 8480 is where we see seepage, so we definitely want to keep it under that. As you can see in the zoomed in section on the right, the heavy snow year over the winter in 2019 caused us a big spike in the mindful elevation that we spent the summer and fall dealing with. And the PRP's contractor just sent us an update this week that the mine pool is currently sitting at 8,465 feet, which is 11 feet lower than the high elevation following the snowmelt in July 2019. We had a level of 8,477. So we're 11 feet lower, and the treatment plant has really been working overtime in 2019 to deal with all that water. A component of the remedy that came online in 1998 is the Liberty Well. The Liberty Well is a 980-foot well that intercepts clean groundwater coming into the mine pool through a drift that connects the Eagle Workings to the Liberty Mine Workings near Red Cliff. The well directly discharges into Willow Creek and is operated under a state discharge permit like Kayleen talked about. The Liberty Well was incorporated as part of the remedy via an explanation of significant differences in 98. However, it has not been included in any enforcement agreement to date. This incorporation into the consent decree we are currently negotiating is an important addition to the enforcement strategy at the site. Water in the drift is clean, but if we overpump it via the well, it can reverse the gradient and begin to pull contaminated mine pool water up through the well. And that is the reason for the discharge permit and the need to monitor the effluent closely. Accessibility is a big issue for maintenance of the Liberty Well. In winter months, snowmobiles are required to reach the well, and so if the pump fails in the winter, the PRP contractors have a really hard time getting up there to replace it. So we really try to keep an eye on the power to the well and just to make sure that it continues operation. Because that's, you know, it's 150 gallons per minute, and so that's 150 gallons per minute less that the water treatment plant has to handle. And so we really focus on keeping that clean water directly discharging into the creek. And there's a schematic here on this slide, obviously not to scale, just to give you an idea of kind of the layout of the drift and the well. Through our annual surface water monitoring program, we observed that in the spring months we were seeing exceedances of the surface water quality standards for copper, cadmium, and zinc in the river due to the flush of metals precipitated by the spring melt. And so this led us to look at alternatives that would allow us to meet those standards year-round via a focused feasibility study. We looked at a number of different alternatives when we were evaluating the remedy, and some of those alternatives included removing waste rock at the site, implementing an iron-rich material reaction wall in Belden or in Rex Flats, groundwater collection and treatment in Belden and Rock Creek, groundwater collection and treatment at Rex Flats and the old tailings pile, or also in-mine precipitation in the mine working. We selected the collection of groundwater at Belden, the base of Rock Creek, and the mill level of the mine as our preferred alternative and issued a friendly unilateral administrative order to the PRP in 2018 to implement this expansion of the remedy. Construction of that additional remedy is complete, and we plan to run the system in spring 2020, so this spring and spring 2021, to assess the effectiveness of capturing that additional metal flow. And the photos that you see on the screen are, that's the area of Belden where we're going to be doing the additional groundwater collection, and then just iron precipitate forming in the area of Belden where groundwater enters the river. So we definitely, you can visibly see that we have an issue there. I have a few slides of before and after photos for you. This first one is of the roaster pile number one remediation. So the original remedy included the removal and consolidation of five different roaster piles at the site. As you can see here, the photo on the left is from 1988, before remediation, and the photo on the right is after remediation. One thing to note here is that we did include revegetation on the roaster pile areas as part of the original remedy, but the slope proved too steep for the reveg to take. These roaster piles were mostly just dumped on the side of the slope once the roasting was done, and so they really were just kind of stuck on the side of a mountain, and so revegetation has proved difficult there. This is the roaster pile number three area in Belden. It was a particularly nasty roaster pile, as you can see by the photo on the left. Overall, we removed over 66,300 cubic yards of roaster waste at the site, and all of that material was consolidated in the consolidated tailings pile. You can see on the right, the photo looks a lot better. The slope has been cut back some to prevent erosion a little bit, and some of that, most of that nasty material is now gone. Also, we can point out here that revegetation was did not take at this roaster pile as well. This next photo, this is just an in remediation photo of that same area, roaster pile number three. And if you look in the top left of the photo, you can see the steepness of the slope, and you can see how the excavator is perched on that side trying to scoop out some of that roaster waste. So it was definitely hard work to get that roaster pile cleaned up, but that had a big impact on the surface water quality, because in this previous slide you can see that the toe of that roaster pile just dug directly into the river. This is a before and after of the old tailings pile. So the photo on the left again is in 1989. The old tailings pile is across the road there in the background of the photo. You see in the forefront the Rex Flats area. You can tell here that in the photo on the right in 1999, our revegetation took very well in the OTP and in Rex Flats. And again, keep in mind that the Rex Flats area needed remediation because that trestle, one of the things the miners did was deposit tailings underneath it to prevent it from ever catching on fire, because that was such a critical component of their operation to be able to slurry all of those tailings down canyon. So you can see on the photo on the right, both Rex Flats in the forefront and the OQP in the background look nice and green, and that's how they still look today. This is a photo of the consolidated tailings pile. Again, in the photo on the left, you can see it was pretty wet because of just all the tailings being flurried down, and it is pretty nasty, no vegetation, very orange. On the photo on the right, you can see this is after construction of the water treatment plant. So in the foreground, you can see the sludge cell and the water treatment plant and the surge pond. And then past the water treatment plant in the background, you can see that nice cap and that gentle slope of the consolidated tailings pile. This is another photo of the CTP before and after. The important thing to take away from this slide is just how important it was that as part of the capping of the CTP, we really cut back that slope to make it more gentle, to allow for revegetation to take, and also to prevent runoff and erosion. And so you can see the revegetation took, the slope looks a lot better. It just overall was a really successful part of the remedy. Molloy Park Wetlands, this is an area north of the consolidated tailings pile. It was never an area of tailings deposition or anything, but it was an area that was contaminated because of tailings overflow from the consolidated tailings pile, or previously called the new tailings pile. So they would slurry all of that material down canyon, dump them in the new tailings pile or consolidated tailings pile, and it would just overflow and it contaminated the Molloy Park wetlands. So as part of the initial remediation, this area was all of the contamination was removed and consolidated into the CTP as well. All right, now that we have covered the enforcement history and the technical aspects of the remedy at the site, we can look forward to the future. What does that look like at Eagle Mine? Like any site that was listed in the early days of CERCLA, there are several things that we need to address prior to get the site wrapped up. You know, the site has been around, the site was has been around as long as I am, right? It was listed in 1986 when I was 3 years old. So we know that we have a lot of stuff that we have to wrap up before we can declare final success of the site. So Kaylee's going to talk a little bit about a couple of items on this slide, and then I'll come back to finish up the presentation.
Sure. So our first step towards getting the site completion is to finalize negotiation of a new consent decree and lodge it with the court. So our goal here is really to ensure long-term operation and maintenance at the site that's consistent and includes all of the components that we have from prior decision documents. And what we're really looking for here is consistency and certainty, and just, you know, much easier to get those things too. So the process there, once we have the CD finalized, or the consent decree finalized, we'll get signatures from the PRP, the state, EPA, and the Department of Justice. And we will file that with the court, and then we'll have a public comment period. It'll be 30 days and can be extended to 60 at a stakeholder's request. If we receive any comments on the consent decree, we'll respond to those, and then DOJ files a motion for the court to enter the consent decree, and we have our new consent decree. The other thing from an enforcement perspective is transitioning from a state permit to state permit equivalent documents to ensure that we're complying with the decision documents that we selected. Specifically here, our concern is we've selected 3 micrograms per liter of arsenic in our decision documents, so we need to get that. We'll have some procedure transitioning out of the state process to the CERCLA process. I won't go into the details there, but so those are just the 2 enforcement things we need to do to move OU1 on down the line.
Thanks, Kaylee. So we have a few other items that we need to wrap up to get to the end goal of what we call the stepping stone of the Superfund process, outlined here in this beautiful graphic on the right that I'm sure everyone has seen a million times. But one big outstanding issue for us at the site is related to groundwater. So I know we've talked a little bit about groundwater at the site. No groundwater restoration remedy has ever been selected for the site. We know that we have metals contaminated groundwater at the old tailings pile, Rex Flat, Belden, Rock Creek, and at the consolidated tailings pile. We do have groundwater collection remedies on the site, but all the remedial objectives for the site to date have been focused on achieving surface water standards in the river. So we have a number of groundwater collection and treatment components at the site, but we have never broached groundwater restoration. CERCLA has an objective of restoring groundwater to beneficial use, so this is something that we have to address prior to being able to achieve site completion. Our big issue at Eagle is that the state of Colorado does not have a comprehensive state groundwater protection program in place, otherwise referred to as a KISWIP. In the 90s, groundwater at the site was evaluated using the state of Colorado classification system. And that classification determined that the water, groundwater at the site was non-drinking water based on a couple of different technical factors like turbidity and pumping volume. But the problem is that this classification was not conducted using the 1986 EPA groundwater classification guidance. And so we've been consulting with APA headquarters about a path forward, and their preliminary stance is that without a KISWIP, a comprehensive state groundwater protection program in place that classifies groundwater on site as non-drinking water, groundwater restoration to drinking water standards is an objective for the site. The team is examining how we want to address this issue at the site. Our current thinking is that we could do a paper exercise of reclassifying the groundwater at the site using that 86 EPA guidance to make those beneficial use determinations for the groundwater at the site, and then assess what classifications the groundwater at the site falls into, and if anything does fit drinking water use based on some of those technical aspects of the groundwater, we can look at remedial strategies to achieve compliance with these standards, including the possible use of technical impracticability waivers to waive drinking water standards where necessary if we need to. So CERCLA does give us a couple of options to deal with groundwater restoration at the site, because we know that that would be a really hard ask for us at the site, at a mining site, to be able to get the groundwater back to drinking water standards. And so currently we're just talking with EPA headquarters, and once we get the consent decree lodged and we're through that process, we're really going to focus on figuring out a strategy to handle groundwater at the site. In the interim, we have institutional controls in place that restrict groundwater use at the site, since we know that groundwater is contaminated. Another aspect of the CERCLA process that we need to get through before site completion is the SWARU measure, so site-wide ready for anticipated use. This is a measure, it's a target for the Superfund program. To get SWARU, a site has to have all aspects of the cleanup in place so that there are no unacceptable risks. The site has to have reached the construction completion milestone, which we did in 2001, and it must have all land use restrictions in place, which we got institutional controls in place over the winter of 2019, and so we have that checked as well. At Eagle, the only thing keeping us from this SWARU measure is the achievement of those surface water quality standards during the spring months, which we are resolving with the expansion of the remedy through the unilateral administrative order. And so we hope to achieve SWARU once the remedy amendment is proven operational and functional. And then, of course, the last thing that we need to achieve is site deletion. So we know that the goal of Superfund is to get contaminated sites cleaned up, back to productive use, and deleted from the NPL. And so sites can achieve partial deletion by operable unit or site-wide deletion of all operable units at once. The team's working on our strategy for Eagle, but we're really leaning towards partial deletion by operable unit, and we hope to move forward with deletion of operable unit 2 in the next year or so. And so those are kind of the outstanding items that we need to get through before we can say that we're done at Eagle. We're really close with the CD and the permit PEDs, and then we can focus on the last three items that you see on the slide. And then you reach the little sun at the end of the Superfund process, which I'm looking forward to. And so I just wanted to include a few photos from the site on my question slide. So the photo on the left, you can see we had a mountain lion visitor at the site. The photo in the top of the frame, we have a lot of rock falls at the site. So we had a rock fall 2 years ago that was so large that we had to have a blasting company come. A rock fell. It was the size of a car. It fell into the middle of the road and blocked access to Belden. And so the PRP had to have someone come and drill and blast to break the rock up to be able to access areas where we have remedy components. And so the last and I think most impressive slide, I feel like this is the epitome of the Darwin Awards, is someone snuck into the mine pool with a raft and a bottle of whiskey to try to have a good time. So that is the Eagle Mine, and we're happy to take questions, and I hope everyone enjoyed the case study.
Well, thank you very, very much, ladies. I'll remind the audience that they have space in their lower right corner where they can privately submit comments and questions. We've already had a number of submissions that came in during the presentation, and so I'm going to start reading through some of these questions, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted today. So I'll just jump right into a question about trespassing. So this first participant asked, as you just highlighted in that closing slide, if trespassing is an issue at the site, what have you done to try to prevent it? Do you have any measures that are effective in limiting trespassing there?
We do. Can you hear me? I just unmuted.
Yeah.
Okay. We do. So we have a number of fences and gates. We have a gate along the road to Belden. So in the photo with the mountain lion, we have a fence along that road that we call the Mad Max Gate because it's a gate across the road where we had to put spikes on either side of it to prevent people from just ramming through it in their cars. And also we got through the developer, so the property owner at the site, which is a development company called Battle Mountain, they implemented some additional fencing and signage in different areas of the site last year through an AOC that we got with them where they instituted some institutional controls at the site. And so, yeah, we work really hard with trying to discourage trespassing. So whenever I talk about Eagle, I like to tell people, it looks cool. Please don't come back. We do a tour every other year, and as part of the tour, we always tell people, you're here because the PRP is happy and the landowner are happy to let us do the tours, but we really discourage trespassing.
Okay. We had a couple of questions come in about the bulkheads. So first, can you indicate if they are flow-through or fixed bulkheads at the site?
So we have a couple of flow through. So the mine drawdown at Adit 5 is flow through, and that's how we pull water from the mine to maintain the mine pool. We have one that the tunnel has collapsed, and so as part of the consent decree, we're working with the PRP to look at what a bulkhead inspection kind of program would look like. We haven't finalized that, but that's one of our goals of the consent decree is to kind of implement a more robust inspection and maintenance program for the bulkheads. But yeah, we have a couple of flow through, and then we had the rest, I think, are just fixed.
Okay, and I think you just sort of hit on this other question. People were wondering, you know, were these bulkheads designed to make monitoring and maintenance easier to do? Or are you using them to look at to monitor and maintain your mine pool elevation?
Originally, I don't think that they were really constructed with the idea of monitoring and maintenance in mind, because originally when it was bulkheaded, we thought, you know, oh, we're going to bulkhead it, and then, hey, we're good, right? Like, all the water's going to stay in. Let's put some more water back in the mine even. But we really, the PRP's contractors have been great at implementing some monitoring of the mine pool through those couple of bulkheads where we have access. So the tip-top at it, that's a flow-through, and we collect that water and send it to the treatment plant. And then the big place where we access water is through Adit 5 and the mine drawdown system there.
Okay, and you are monitoring the bulkheads. Is there a routine schedule for that?
There is not currently a routine schedule, but that is something we are negotiating with the PRP right now on what that would look like. And, since we're not bulkhead experts, we're really looking towards to the Colorado Division of Reclamation and Mining Safety to help us figure out what that inspection program would look like.
Can you talk a little bit about how the water, how the collected water is actually conveyed over to your water treatment plants?
Sure, yeah. So water's collected in a number of different areas. So we have different seepage collection areas throughout the site. So we have some waste rock diversion ditches. We have just some seepage areas that we know we see seepage. So we have seepage basins there. Everything is piped down to a pipeline that runs along the river, in Belden, and then across Rex Flats on the elevated trestle, and then to the water treatment plant. We actually implemented last year, we're no longer carrying that water over the trestle. Historically, the trestle has been our primary pipeline for carrying the water down from the mine. But we know that that was, it was really hard to maintain that because it gets so cold there in the wintertime. It's hard to access. It's not, it just wasn't a very effective corridor for us to carry the water down. And so last year, the PRP actually buried a new pipeline along the road next to the trestle. So now all of our pipe is buried, which is a lot better for the remedy, and a lot, it gives us a lot more confidence that we're not going to see any leakage.
And a couple of people have asked about seepage. So could you talk a bit about how those consolidated tailings piles were designed to try to prevent seepage or minimize it?
Yeah, so the CCP is not lined. Everything, because it was already a tailings pile, everything was consolidated there. And we have groundwater extraction trenches, so along the north side and the east side of the CCP. And those trenches are, I think they're 15 feet deep, and they capture all that contaminated groundwater that flows through the tailings before going to the Eagle River. And all of those trenches are both pumped to the water treatment plant for treatment. So that groundwater in the CTP is captured and sent for treatment as well.
Okay. We had another participant that wanted to know if you have ever found the source of cadmium in your water sampling.
I do not know the answer to that. I can look, though, and see. I know that cadmium is kind of another one of those statewide analytes that the Water Quality Control Commission is looking at, and so I don't know if that is more of a statewide analyte or if there is something site-specific, but I can look into that if you want to have them pass on that question to me.
We also had a few questions just on the total cost. Do you have a bulk cost for what this remedy is expected to cost?
We do not. You know, since this is a PRP-funded site, we have never, that's not a requirement in our enforcement agreements for the PRP to share their costs with us. I think we've estimated that a water treatment plant is around like $1 million a year to operate, and that's just kind of a EPA Region 8 estimate that I've gotten from people. But overall, I honestly don't have a good number for how much that the PRP has spent. But if you just think about $1 million a year and the water treatment plant alone has been operating since 1991, it's definitely a lot of money.
I'm going to go back to a few more technical questions, and this one getting into the sludge production. Do you have an estimate on how much sludge is being produced at your treatment plant and where you're disposing of the sludge?
I know we dispose of the sludge. We have an on-site sludge disposal cell, a line cell in the CTP, so we're actually really lucky at Eagle because we have that flat area at the CTP where we have room for the sludge disposal cell and the surge ponds. We have two line surge ponds and the water treatment plant. We actually, the PRP was evaluating whether or not to move the water treatment plant last year, and they did kind of a feasibility assessment on costs and if it would be feasible to move the water treatment plant because we still are in the plant that was constructed in 91. Everyone decided that the plant needed to stay in place because we had that flat area where we can have the sludge disposal cell and where we can have the surge pond. So the PRP has been just refurbishing the water treatment plant kind of in a phased approach. So they just relined the reactor tanks and we relined one of the surge ponds last year. So they're just working through ticking off those items to refurbish the plant. As for volume of our sludge, honestly, I don't really know how much that is, but I could check with the PRP and get that answer back out to folks if that is something of interest.
All right, great. Thank you. And again, I want to thank everybody who's been chiming in with those questions. We'll continue to try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have left. Our next question is actually coming about an acronym that you referenced. So earlier in the presentation, I believe you referenced SWARU, and one of the participants asked if you could define that or explain what that meant.
Yeah, sure. So SWARU is a measure site-wide ready for anticipated use. And so it's just a measure that shows that a site has achieved all the aspects of the cleanup, so there are no unacceptable risks present. So basically that you're all of the remedial components have been implemented to achieve your remedial action objectives, that you have reached that construction completion milestone, and that you have all necessary land use restrictions in place. So it's really that measure that shows that your site is buttoned up and presents no unacceptable risk to human health or the environment.
Okay. A couple of other questions have come in about groundwater background studies. So they just were interested if you had done or there were any background studies to give you more of a sense of what the groundwater quality was typically like in that mineralized mining area?
You know, honestly, I don't know. That is one item on the to-do list for us when we start trying to target that groundwater determination and our groundwater path forward. There's been so much work at the site historically because it has been around so long that Dustin McNeil from the state of Colorado, who's the project manager for the state, and I, a lot of times we are able to find info to answer questions that we have if we just look back at the record. So that is the one joy of being handed a site that's been around for so long. It's like a joy and a curse, right? You have this huge record to dig through, but you can also usually find what you need. And so that is one thing that we need to start looking for once we want to start focusing on that groundwater determination.
Okay. And I just wanted to read a couple of comments. It looks as though we have some other participants who have been listening who may be involved in the site. And so Charles is here, and he chimed in with a comment that he doesn't have an exact volumetric measurement, but that they typically move about 3 dump trucks per week to the sludge cell. And it appears to be mostly lime. So, Jamie, I don't know if you can comment on that or that sounds about accurate to you.
Yeah, that does sound accurate. That was the one thing I was going to say is I could maybe ask David Hines. Thanks, David Hines.
Yes, and David also chimes in here as well that the water treatment plant is generating about 1,200 to 1,500 cubic yards of dewatered sludge per year. So thank you to those of you who are involved in this site and work with some of the technical components for chiming in with some of the information to help with these questions. Thank you. So we will carry on here with some of the other questions that have come in. Some of these I'm going to try to get through ones that I think that we can get into. Some of them are more detailed process questions, so we might not have time to get through all of them, but I do want to thank everybody who's been sharing them. There were questions about sort of the long-term approach with your groundwater. For example, could you go back and revisit? You had talked earlier about potentially reclassifying the groundwater. Could you talk a little bit more about if you reclassified the groundwater, does that have an impact to where you could put wells in the area? If the groundwater itself is reclassified and you've got hydraulic connections in there?
Yeah, that is, I think, the one big question, right, is do we have areas in the site? Because we have these different aquifers at the site that we need to look at. And so I think it will have an impact on, for sure, on if wells can be placed at the site. Right now we just have a blanket groundwater restriction institutional control in place through the state of Colorado's environmental covenant statute. So the property owner, Battle Mountain, who is proposing the redevelopment, went ahead with the state in implementing a restrictive notice at the site to restrict groundwater use. And so, yeah, I think when we get to that point where we have a better idea of what we're looking at with the groundwater, because honestly, we've been so focused on getting the new consent decree specs in place that we haven't focused a lot on the groundwater. But I do think it's going to have an impact on kind of what those institutional controls are going to look like moving forward. But right now, we just have the blanket groundwater use restriction in place to prevent any access to that groundwater.
Okay. I'm going to jump over here to a question, and I apologize. Sometimes questions come in on previous topics, so I'm not able to – they come in after I ask something. Somebody asked a question going back to those bulkheads. Is there water drawdown completed or done in order to keep the bulkhead pressure in check?
No. The reason that we – have the mine drawdown system is more to maintain the mine pool level at a level where we don't see seepage. So we don't really have the concern of any pressure buildup or like any hydraulic head building up behind the bulkhead. But we do have the biggest thing that I think we want to implement the inspection program for is just that, you know, nothing is designed, even though things are designed for 100 years or whatever, a bulkhead is not designed for an infinite amount of time. And when you think about the timeline of Eagle, you know, some of those bulkheads were put in 88, so they've been in there for a while. So we just need to start, we just want to have a more robust inspection program to look at them. But, yeah, we don't really have we don't have any fears of blowouts or anything at the site. We're confident in the bulkhead design capacity. We're just not confident not having eyes on them all the time, you know.
Yeah. We had a couple of questions about the actual deletion process, and so people were asking you to revisit when this, like the mechanism or the requirements in order to delete this site from the NPL. Specifically, they were interested, can you delete a site if you still have active water treatment ongoing at the site?
Yes. So deletion, what we always tell our stakeholder group, and I kind of have started talking about this idea of deletion with them, is that deletion doesn't mean the EPA walks away or the state walks away or the PRP walks away. Deletion just means that all the work has been implemented at the site and that you've achieved all of your remedial action objectives. There's no unacceptable risk at the site. So as long as the PRP continues the active water treatment, then we know we will continue to meet our remedial action objectives. And so, yeah, you can definitely delete a site and still have active treatment because then the site is just in operations and maintenance. So we still will do five-year reviews. We'll still oversee the operations and maintenance at the site, but it won't be on the list. It won't be on the national priorities list anymore because we've achieved the cleanup there, if that makes sense.
Okay. A number of people have asked if there are funding mechanisms if the PRP is unable to pay for the cleanup.
I'm sorry, you broke up. Is there a contingency? Is that what you said?
Yeah, contingencies are funding mechanisms. What if the PRP finds themselves in a position where they cannot pay for the cleanup? Are there other funding mechanisms?
Ooh, I'm throwing that one over to Kayleen.
So people can look at the model consent decree on EPA's website for remedial actions. We have different financial assurance mechanisms available to us that are kind of founded in RCRA statute. So we'll negotiate that during these consent decree negotiations, but I can't speak to them now. You can look to past enforcement documents we have at the site. The PRP in the past has funded a surety bond at the site for a long time. So our eyes are certainly on that issue. I can't speak to what's going on with this current consent decree because it's still being negotiated, but we have implemented financial assurance mechanisms in the past at the site.
Okay. I have another enforcement-related question, Kayleen, so if you'll stay close. Could you talk about any NRD restoration? Was that involved at all at this site?
You know, unfortunately, I don't have too much information on it, mostly because it was so long ago, and the consent decree remedial action plan really focused on response actions at the site. So I need to look into that a little more. It hasn't been as relevant to the enforcement work we've been doing recently, but I can put that on my list and circle back with who asked the question.
Okay. We also have a question about TI waivers. So I believe we may bounce back to you, Jamie. Just generally, I think you had talked about potentially trying to get a TI waiver at the site. Is that correct?
Yes. So we currently have a TI waiver for arsenic in the surface water, but we have thought about the possibility of using a TI waiver if we do that classification for groundwater, and it shows us that the groundwater is potentially drinkable, but we know that we would never, I don't think, it would be really hard to get groundwater restored to drinking water standards. And so there is, CERCLA gives us that TI waiver functionality to be able to waive that drinking water standard as an ARAR.
And we had a few people who were asking, because they're relatively new to this whole world of cleanup, when you're going forward with the TI waiver, who is involved in the sort of acceptance of it? Are the states involved in negotiating a TI waiver?
Let me tell you, everybody's involved in a TI waiver, I think. So the state, and, you know, I just want to say that at Eagle, we are so lucky that our relationship with the state of Colorado is so great, and our relationship with the PRP is really good as well. So we're really achieving things in a quicker fashion than we ever have because of the team at the site. So I just want to give everyone a shout out on my Eagle Mine State and EPA team, as well as the PRP's contractors at the site are really great and give us a lot of confidence. But for a TI waiver, the state for sure would be on board. That would be a headquarters consultation for EPA. So we would go to headquarters to get their buy-in on it. We would probably, I'm sure, talk to our, we have a really active stakeholder group at the site. We have a lot of really technical folks that attend our stakeholder meetings because they're with the Eagle River Water and Sanitation District or the Eagle River Watershed Council, so they're all well-versed in the world of water quality, so I'm sure we would talk to them about it as well. We're pretty open at Eagle about our process and about, you know, when we're thinking about doing something, we like to get everyone's buy-in. We're very collaborative at the site, so I assume we would talk to everyone about it, honestly.
And this is Kayleen. We do have pretty extensive guidance available on the website that delves into this issue more.
Okay. Kayleen, do you have any information about how you got to a UAO at this site?
The 2018 UAO?
Yeah, I believe so. They were just interested in if, like, how that process or that actually came about rather than going through a more formal enforcement instrument.
So the UAO is a formal enforcement instrument. We used that here after doing some discussion with the PRP because we wanted to implement the ROD amendment work as soon as we can. And consent decrees can take a long time to negotiate, particularly the one that we're negotiating here, because it's operation and maintenance of all of the remedial components that we've ever looked at the site. And the ROD amendment work was much smaller. It was that additional collection. So the statement of work was easy to pull together. A unilateral administrative order is a much shorter enforcement document. We don't spend a lot of time or any time really negotiating the substance of it. So it wasn't meant to be a real threatening vehicle here. We weren't implying that the PRP was being recalcitrant, just that we wanted to be able to do work the upcoming construction season, and that was the easiest way for us to implement it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We still have a few more questions, so we'll try to get through these ones. Interesting one. Have any water purveyors approached EPA or the state on rights to getting clean water?
Yeah, I can't speak to the state, but that is definitely outside of our wheelhouse. In Western water law, water rights are big-time property rights issue, so kind of outside of our wheelhouse.
Okay. All right. We had another question that I'm going to go back to some of the groundwater work that you're doing. And my apologies, Jamie, if you had addressed this earlier, but someone had chimed in and asked if inflow of groundwater into that CPT can be reduced, or you can't because you haven't, not just yet, because you haven't evaluated your groundwater.
So is the question, can inflow of groundwater into the CPP be reduced? Oh yeah, I see Tim Buckson's question. So the consolidated tailings pile was capped with an engineered cap to prevent infiltration. So we also have a component at the site that I didn't talk about, the upgradient diversion trench. So this is an upgradient trench, upgrading of the consolidated tailings pile that captures clean groundwater before it can make it into the consolidated tailings pile. So that is a big component of the remedy that helps a lot with that groundwater infiltration into the CTP. So we really work, you know, we try to keep the CTP really well vegetated. We know that we do inspection of the cap every year to make sure that the cap is still looking good and that we don't see any big erosion or settlement issues in the cap. And then we make sure that that upgrading and diversion trench is operational to capture clean groundwater so it doesn't make it into the CTP.
Okay, I think I'll take one more question, and then we're going to run out of time here. So this last question is about groundwater contamination. One participant wanted to know if you have any upgradient contamination of the groundwater, because they're thinking that this might make meeting your drinking water standards pretty difficult.
Sorry, the first half of the question broke up. I'm sorry. Could you say it one more time?
They were asking, is the groundwater upgradient of the site contaminated?
Oh, no, it is not. Yeah, so that that upgradient area, upgrading of the CGP, we know is clean. And then Cross Creek is a tributary to the Eagle, and it is also a clean water source too. So, yeah, upgradient groundwater looks good, but we know the CGP is hot.
Thank you. So I know that there were many other questions and comments. I apologize we couldn't get to everything that we had in the queue for today, but I wanted to turn it back to you, Jamie and Kayleen. Any final thoughts that you want to leave the audience with?
I would just say, you know, I've been an RPM since 2015, and when I got handed Eagle Mine, it was very overwhelming because of the long history of the site, but it's been really fun kind of negotiating, trying to get this long, this site with a long history through the process. And now that we're getting close to where we can see the finish line, it's just a really exciting time for us at the site. And, yeah, I think that's all I would have to say.
Yeah, this is Kayleen. I think something that I've learned is you can spend all of your time trying to be as detail-oriented as you can, and things just come up that you didn't anticipate. So it's important to remain flexible. Don't beat yourself up too much. Just kind of keep trucking along. So that's what we're trying to do. I think we're excited to kind of button some things up, get some clarity. We're looking forward to the next year at the site.
Thank you. And ladies, one other question. For those that are very interested in learning more about this site and additional activities that will be taking place, where can they go to learn more or sort of stay on top of what's happening at Eagle Mine?
So you could email me. So this is Jamie. You can email me, and I can put you on our email list. So whenever we have stakeholder meetings, we do quarterly stakeholder meetings, usually in Avon, which is close to the site. So you can email me, and I can put you on that stakeholder list. And then that way, whenever we have any, you know, any important documents that need to go out or any information that needs to be shared, we share it through that email list.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Oh, was there another one? Nope. Okay. All right. Well, it looks like we've just got about 2 minutes left, and we'll go ahead and walk through our final conclusion, concluding reminders. Again, sorry that we didn't have enough time to go through everything live, but as noted, there are follow-on ways to stay informed and learn more about what's taking place at that site. So I encourage you to reach out to Jamie, as she instructed by email, so that you can stay informed on what's taking place at Eagle Mine. I want to thank the over 200 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live broadcast. This was available to everyone here in the U.S. as well as international participants, so thank you very much. I also want to thank our experts for joining us from the site, as well as Michelle Mahoney, to help share their information on today's webinar. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, you'll find those on the seminar homepage or seminar links page. So if you look on the middle right of your screen, you can click to those links and then press the Browse To button to actually open them up locally on your own computer. If you are looking for contact information for our presenters, again, you'll also find that on the seminar homepage. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, those links will still work for you, so you can still click through them. I will ask each of you to take a moment to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that we covered as well as the mechanism that we used to host it. A number of people will often ask me for participation certificates. We do issue them, but in order to get one, you have to fill out a seminar feedback form. So please be sure to follow the link to the seminar feedback form, and when you're filling it out, as long as you check the box at the bottom of the form, you will then immediately have access to that certificate that you can either save or print out when you submit the form on in. But if you don't check the box or you enter your email address incorrectly, then obviously we won't be able to email it to you. If you happen to participate in a group, each person can fill out that form even if they didn't register on their own. So if you join together in a conference room, I would ask the person who registered to copy that seminar feedback form link and share it with those of you who joined them so that they can give in their own comments but get their own certificate for their own records. And again, for those of you watching the recorded version, you can still follow that link to share feedback based off of the archived version of today's webinar. You'll receive an automated email from me in about 1 week or so when that archive is available for on-demand playback. So with that, again, I will formally thank you all so very much for joining us.